Jarring Cacophony tells you that once again, it's Power of Three podcast time. Woohoo! You're back with us as we continue on our quest to count down to the arrival of the first series of 1, 2, 3. Shuri-ga-wa, Shuri-ga-wa. And we're all ready for that, aren't we? I think we are. Today we're taking a look at an adventure featuring another Scottish Doctor, his predecessor by three. We are looking at Plague City, which was the 62nd novel in the BBC News series Adventures Run, with the 12th Doctor, Bill Potts, and Nardole. And it was written by Jonathan Morris. It was released on the 20th of April 2017 and had a cover by Lee Binding. So, what does the cover blurb have to tell us about this one? The year is 1645, and Edinburgh is in the grip of the worst plague in its history. Nobody knows who will be next to succumb. Nobody except the Night Doctor, a masked figure that stalks the streets, seeking out those who will not live to see another day. But death is not the end. The Doctor, Bill, and Nardole discover that the living are being haunted by the recently departed, by ghosts that do not know they are dead. And there are other creatures lurking in the shadows, slithering, creeping creatures, filled with an insatiable hunger. The Doctor and his friends must face the terrifying secret of the Street of Sorrows. That something, which has lain dormant for 200 million years, is due to destroy the entire city. So yes, I think you could imagine that with it being set in Scotland, of course it's going to be popular with this podcast. The fact it was written by Jonathan Morris, another win, and it's set in some very recognisable locations. So if you've ever been to Edinburgh, you'll have been up and down the Royal Mile, I'm sure, been to Edinburgh Castle, and probably taken a wee walk around Arthur's Seat, the extinct volcano that's in the heart of the city with lovely parklands around it, down beside the Scottish Parliament. It's a great book. Thoroughly enjoyed it, with some fantastic locations that you can actually go and visit. You can go and visit the real Mary King's Close these days. Interestingly enough, we previously featured The Many Hands, a 10th Doctor novel which was set in Edinburgh back in time, and it too featured Mary King's Close. So there's definitely something about that place that's worth visiting. I've actually never been, but I do keep talking about it and thoroughly intend to visit it this summer at some point. But yes, it's a great book. There's the Night Doctor, that typical masked figure with that beaky look to them, and the fact that we've got Nardole gets some great stuff to do. I especially like the fact that Nardole arrives and he's dressed up in a sort of Scottish way and claims to be of Scottish heritage, as he's a member of the clan McNardole. And yeah, just I can just so picture Matt Lucas wearing a kilt and sporran, and of course his duffel jacket, and I'm sure at one point he wears a berry, a bit like Minnie the Minx, that comic creation from Dundee, who originally appeared in The Beano. Oh, what else do I like about it? Oh, there's also the fact that the Doctor mentions that he might just have been involved in creating the Edinburgh Festival celebrations, and of course Hogmanay, or New Year's Eve to the rest of you outside Scotland. So yes, there's all these lovely wee hints that pull all together to give it a really good Scottish feel. And of course the text is written in a Scots sort of way, so I got to follow it, so I don't know how you guys managed. So if you guys had any opinions, let us know on social media and how you found it to listen to. Now at this point we'd normally drop in an audiobook clip, but unfortunately this one was never given an official release, which is a real shame, because it would have been great. I can particularly imagine Peter Capaldi reading this one and doing it with great relish and doing a variety of different Scots accents. Alternatively, I think it would have been good having Matt Lucas doing it, given that we know he can do a Scots accent when he's done Little Britain. Anyway, enough about that. Let's head over to meet the author.
I'm Jonathan Morris, and I wrote Doctor Who Plague City.
So was this a bit of a treat for you, Johnny, being invited back by Justin to come and do another Doctor Who novel?
Yes, I hadn't done one for a long time, I think, by 6 or 7 years. It's been quite a big gap. I've been keeping busy with other things. I wasn't like sitting sobbing into my tea, but it was lovely just to go, okay, I can do a 12th Doctor thing now, you know, because I'd done things, I did comic strips and stuff for the 10th Doctor and the 11th Doctor, but I hadn't really done anything for Peter Capaldi's Doctor. And I could sort of, I think the sort of the excitement was just going, I can see that there's things I could do there, things I can play with. And I mean, the other sort of big thrill was to have Bill and Nardole, because they were new, and to go, okay, I'm going to be part of the new series, the comeback series, as it were. And yeah, it was just lovely to be asked. I think the only sort of, I wouldn't even say it was a downside, but the thing that might have given me pause was the deadline, which I think I had about 4 weeks to write it. It was, I think I was asked around Christmas, and the deadline was the end of January or something. It was just really, really tight. You know, because Touched by an Angel was done in 3 months. And although this is like a much shorter book, it was still, you know, okay, everything else has to be put aside for a month so I can do this, basically. And there were two other people who were commissioned at the same time as me, who I think was George and Cav. And Justin said, okay, one of you's doing present day Earth, one of you's doing space and or the future, and one of you's doing history. And I was doing, okay, well, I'll do history, because that means I have, at least I have a setting where I don't have to make it up. But then it was like, okay, I've got a setting where I know I've got 4 weeks to write a book, and I have to spend 1 week of that researching it and finding out this about this piece of period of history. And with all these things, you're sort of going, okay, I just need to know enough so that I can include lots of little details that show I've done my research. And I need to know enough so that when I'm getting stuff wrong, I'm doing it deliberately for the sake of the story, and I'm not doing it accidentally because I'm ignorant. And I think generally I don't recall any sort of quibbles there. So I think I must have got away with it. It was very tight anyway.
So having a setting in Edinburgh, I suppose that was quite a nice thing to do with Capaldi's Doctor, given that he'd only sort of been to Scotland once on TV with the Eaters of Light, or he would be eventually, in that wibbly wobbly timey wimey way.
Yeah, as one of these things is just going, there's been lots of stories, you know, set in London, and you just want to go, where's an interesting place? Where's an interesting period of history that hasn't been done? And I don't know if Peter Capaldi's from Edinburgh or where he's from, but I think he's not that different from that area. You know, I realise, you know, if I say he's from Kilmarnock, that, you know, people in Scotland would go, that's a completely different area.
He's from Glasgow, from Bishopbriggs.
Yeah, Glasgow. Well, that's very close. So I'm not sure it actually came from him being Scottish. It was just an interesting area. And also, I'd been to Edinburgh about 4 or 5 times before that, on various sort of holidays, you know, to see the festival or go to weddings or whatever. And I've been to the Mary King's Close, which is a real place, and it's a real place you can still visit. And, you know, when you're sort of being shown around these fairly sort of nondescript sort of cellars, basically, and the tour guide is trying to go, and there is tell that they, I mean, there's a brilliant comedian who does the sort of Colin the tour guide, but of trying to make it sound interesting when there's very there's just rubble at best and a dark hole in the game, and they're trying to make a story about it. But I was sort of, I think I sort of put it aside, going, okay, there's a Doctor Who story here, particularly the idea, the myth, I think it's not true, that the plague victims were sealed in there. I don't think that actually happened. But it's a nice idea. It's a nice dramatic idea. It's very scary. So that was where it came from, going, okay, and the plague, and the fact that Edinburgh was in quarantine, and it means you have a smaller cast because the streets are empty. And also, I mean, the most important thing is you have a scary thing, which is the plague doctor, you know, in the famous mask with the hat and the beak, which is, you know, a classic Doctor Who baddie. Because, you know, it's scary and incredibly cheap to do, which is the magical combination, which is Doctor Who. And that hadn't been done. And go, okay, let's have Plague Doctor being in it. The other starting point, as it were, was I, years, about 10 years before, I'd pitched a comic strip called Seat of Power, which is about, which is in Edinburgh, and about an alien spaceship that's got an intelligence underneath Arthur's seat, where it's creating ghosts to try and scare people away. So a big chunk of that actually ended up in the book. All the stuff in the tunnel with a hologram of a mammoth, or a psychic projection of a mammoth, that was from that comic strip years ago. So you see, nothing's ever used it, ever wasted. It just goes, okay, its time has not yet come, you know, but if I think it's a good idea, eventually someone else will too.
So they get in there first. Now, how did you find writing for Nardole and for Bill, given that they wouldn't have been on TV at this point? Were you given early viewings or some scripts?
Well, I had a bit of... They've been on TV. Nardole had been in the superhero one, The Return of Dr. Mysterio. So we had a bit of Nardole, and we had a little bit of Bill, where there's the preview clip of her with the Dalek, and it's, you know, introducing Paul Mackie as Bill. Yeah, the famous typo. So I had that, and they sent the scripts for most of series 10 over, with the shooting scripts. So up till, not including everything apart from the Cyberman story. So I read those and sort of devoured them and analysed them and loved them. So I was going, these are actually really, really good. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was, because sometimes, you know, Doctor Who is nothing if it's not famous for its variety. But these were good, really good. And, you know, I loved Oxygen in particular. I thought that was a phenomenal script. And The Lie of the Land was great. But, you know, they're all really, really good. You know, and so I was going through, okay, making notes, going, okay, this is what we know about Bill. This is not what we find out about Nardole, which is quite complicated because whether Nardole's a robot or not, it just goes, whatever, however Stephen Moffat was feeling on the day, you know, what line Matt Lucas decided to change his nature.
Yeah, I think you absolutely got Nardole just bang on, just like with his almost that sort of offhand sort of little boy lost in what's going on, sort of just that wonderful detached. Odd. He's brilliant.
Yeah, he is odd. He's sort of, because there's a bit of, I mean, I think that the sort of key moment is in Excelis, or Extremis, sorry, where he mentions to Bill that he's got orders to kick the Doctor's ass, and suddenly he realises that Nardole is basically playing a sort of this little buffoon to keep himself entertained, as it were, while actually he's deadly serious underneath. He's actually not a sort of joke after all. And I think, you know, Matt Lucas is a great actor and just wonderful with it. So, and I was in, because I had the shooting scripts, I was seeing stuff which didn't end up on television. So there's references in the book to stuff that didn't end up being seen, or things like Bill thinking, recognizing things in terms of science fiction films. I mean, I loathe the word, but, you know, tropes, as it were, which was a keynote throughout, I think, all the episodes, but then got cut out of most of them. So it just sort of turns up suddenly in the Ice Warrior episode. But I was going, okay, that's a thing, you know, that's really cool. But if something happens and it's a bit like from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, she'll point that out. So I had fun with things like that. And I had about 4 weeks, I had about 1 week left to finish the book, I think. And then I was invited up to, I don't think it was Cardiff, I think it was just BBC Broadcasting House, to watch tapes of the first two or three episodes to get an idea of the characters. And I was, you know, I was going, I really want to go. I've never been invited to anything. That would be lovely. but I was going, unfortunately, I'll probably get that day. It's more important that I stay at home and write the book than it is that I have this lovely opportunity to go up to London and watch the episodes 3 months before anyone else. So I didn't. But I had emails from Cav going, all you need to know is that the doctor's nice now. You know, he's not as grumpy. He's funny and charming, and he has empathy, which I think was a note they had in the previous years where this doctor's alien and he doesn't understand human emotions. Now it's like, they're not doing that anymore. So I'd written him okay. I hadn't got it wrong, so I didn't need to worry, because I'd been taking stuff from the scripts anyway, where he was much nicer. I think he'd been softened a lot in the Dr. Mysterio episode I'd seen anyway. So yeah, I mean, it was great. And Bill prompted me to include the characters of Betsy and Agnes, who are this sort of a lesbian couple. One of them's a ghost, because you know, there were no rules to love. And I included that because I wanted to show that, you know, there were gay and lesbian couples throughout history. And they tended, I think, to just live invisibly, as it were, because they were just people who everyone went, oh, that's just Agnes and Betsy happen to live together. They're really good friends. You know, or they're, you know, Kenny and Brian or whatever, you know. It's because, you know, when I was growing up in my little village, there was a couple, and it'd be spoken in hush terms, they're apians, you know. But actually, it was just, it was present and accepted, I think, because, so I want to include that, just to include a bit more, I don't know if diversity is the right word, just interest. When people talk about including diversity in stories, I just find it much more interesting if you have a wide variety of characters. You know, it means the reader can remember which one is which, and all these different. And you know, you want, like, making the Doctor, Annabelle Ray, who is a sort of historical figure, but not as I wrote her, making that character a woman again. It's not hugely radical or daring or brave, but it just means it's much more interesting than having a male doctor, you know, in that particular period of history. It's just like, oh, and that explains why she dresses up in a plague doctor outfit. So it has a plot reason too. So yeah, that's what inspired me from Bill and Ardol.
Yeah, brilliant. Something that I enjoyed is the fact that the book is written with the Scots dialect as being very much as it would be spoken. And I notice you've got people such as Robert Dick and Andrew Smith in there as language consultants.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in sort of two minds about that. I didn't want to get it wrong. That's the most important. I really didn't want to have stuff in there where, no, just where it would sound wrong, where it would be clunky, because it's difficult to write in a dialect which sort of still exists, but not quite as it did then, whatever. And I didn't want to make it like, you know, the Scottish characters from I'm Sorry, I'll Read It Again or something. You know, oh, you'll be having your tea. So I did have these consultants who I didn't send the whole book. I just sent those bits. Possibly because I hadn't written the rest of the book at that point, to go, can you make sure that this is in Scottish, please? And they did, and there was about five or six of them, it was quite a lot, and they all contradicted each other. You know, they all had different ideas about what would be authentic, which is really useful, because I could just, and I was going, okay, I'll take a vote on it, going, okay, three of you think it should be this, and two of you think it should be this, so the three of you win. I think I went too far with that. I think I went much too far in terms of some of the weird spellings and some of the weird foreshortenings of words. I mean, it's not wrong, but
I understood it all.
Well, yeah, you're native. but I think it was just, okay, that I might have taken it too far, because the whole point was not to make it authentic Scottish of the time. It was just to avoid getting it wrong. but in trying so hard to avoid getting wrong, I think I went too far the other way of including weird spellings like it's an edition of The National or something.
Other newspapers are definitely available.
Yeah.
Anyway, the fact that we've got these ghosts wandering around and sort of gathering en masse, I thought was wonderful imagery. And then particularly when we get below the surface, of course, we get to find out there's a lot more going on there as to where these ghosts are coming from.
Yeah, the plotting, I was just been looking at the book and it was very much, because it's the Stephen Moffat era, you're trying to include those sort of twists. You know, the idea that the plague doctor is hollow. There's no one inside the costume, it's just the outfit on its own. It's a spoiler, sorry. Or the doctor's nip back in time at the in a sort of timey-wimey, but pretend to be the plague doctor for a plot reason later on. So it's twists like that, and it's twists like, okay, they're ghosts that don't realize they're ghosts, which is kind of a even spookier idea, that they think they're still alive and that they can still remember things and learn. But they don't remember dying. And then you realize it's because they've been uploaded basically into this sort of psychic projector at the moment just before death. And so you have this sort of, again, it's another Moffat-y thing of people are visited on their deathbeds by the plague doctor. And so you think, oh God, he's killing them all. But he's not, he's just making copies of them all before they die. And things like the leeches again. It's like you think they're, you think the spaceship is trying to do the symptoms and bad, but it's actually trying to save them because it's being poisoned by the amount of grief and stuff. So it's actually it's trying to sort of just develop a story where it's twists after twists after twists. Because I think that's the style of the time, and certainly it sort of makes it easier to write, because if you're writing something working towards a twist, you go, okay, for everything I write, I've actually got to set up this other piece of information alongside it, underneath, as it were, buried. And the more of those things you have to do, the more jobs you have to do, you're left. It's like basically, it's like if you've got a page of notes, of a thousand words of notes, and for a scene which is 1,000 words, you go, all I need to do is just turn my notes into the scene. And that's much more easy, rather than going, I've got one sentence and I've got to make 1,000 words out of that, because then you've got to think.
Oh, most enjoyable, and particularly the whole image of these leeches, sort of these little things that you cannot see attaching themselves to you and then having to be removed, and they're horrible, horrible, and all the fact it's all triggered by emotions.
Yeah, I mean, again, I was probably working in terms of things like the dream crabs and things like that. I think there have been several sort of ideas along those things, and certainly that the emotion leeches, because I mean, that is an expression for the sort of the grief leeches is someone who, if someone's got bad news, you've got these friends who suddenly appear because they love being with people who are depressed. Like vicariously, they enjoy it. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think that's one of the less effective parts of the story, to be honest. I think the ghosts are a much better part of it. But I was reading it back, and the idea of them being disguised by being just out of phase with time, which is an idea from Mummy on the Orient Express. I was going, okay, we can bring that back and use that.
We also had the whole imminent danger of Arthur's Seat exploding again as the volcanic eruptions build up underneath. The fact it's been kept in place by the crashed spaceship. I love that as a notion, because I've always thought I'd love to see a real live volcano. Maybe not in the heart of Edinburgh, but it's just that thing. I'm going to go to Iceland one day just so I can see a live volcano.
Yeah, I mean, that was from the original comic strip idea, but you just need something which is going to have a big threat, and that sort of dramatic. And also, I think I was having fun because actually I see this idea about it, of the doctor going, you can't change history, you can't do anything that affects stuff. And that's, you know, that's the normal sort of Doctor Who dilemma. And then you sort of, the payoff is to go, and a volcano erupts in Edinburgh, and they just go, we'll never mention it again, you know. So the idea is to almost to create a set of rules and then break that rule, because then it's something, it's a nice surprise. And it was quite dramatic. I got the geography of Edinburgh slightly wrong, because I was thinking, as you're walking down the high street from the castle, you can see Arthur's Seat in the distance, and you can't. And you certainly wouldn't have then, when the houses were 13 stories high and the street was, you know, two stories lower than it is now. But I think if it was Doctor Who, you know, you pretend you could see Arthur's Seat at the end of that road, end of that street. And you certainly didn't. If it was a volcano blown up, you'd certainly see, you know, some flames in the sky. So,
that's, yeah,
I mean, it's also just trying to think of a good climax and having all the ghosts flying about at the same time in the street. And the Doctor's solution, which we can talk about in a bit, because that's one of my favourite bits of the story.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I love the fact that it's the very timey-wimeyness of it, and the fact that it's picking up on something that's there right at the start. The clue is there, and I love the fact that he is the one who does the saving and gives everybody the happy ending.
Yeah. The going back in time to set things up thing is kind of... it's very Stephen Moffat, and it's very... It's effective, I think, actually, because, you know, the scene, the opening scene of the story is this scary moment, and then you actually realise it was the Doctor in the costume all along. But the bit I love is just using the idea of the Doctor playing the guitar and singing as this lure for these creatures that feed on grief. You know, he just appears from the shadows, or appears from the fog of Edinburgh, and he's playing, I guess, How Soon Is Now by the Smiths.
Yep, and then follows up with some Joy Division.
Yeah.
Tears Apart.
Yeah. I'd asked on Twitter or whatever it was for, you know, the most depressing songs that he could play. And there's a Proclaimers song in there as well, which is a cover the Proclaimers did on their first album. I think it's My Old Friend the Blues, I think it was. Yes, it's by Steve Earle originally. So having the idea of, you know, almost taking the curse off this idea that the Doctor's turning up in sunglasses and an electric guitar, which had happened in the Dalek story, and it was not met with sort of overwhelming acclaim when it was done. And to go, actually, no, that could be a thing we could use and bring it back and take the curse off it, and that make it actually seem rather cool. And it's one of those things that just go, what you want is, with any of these sort of books or projects, is to go, okay, if it was on TV, you know, what would people love? What would be the moment they go, what would be the moment in the book, you know? And there's two or three bits, and that's one of them, of I want that to be the bit. You know, when I was writing, a big smile on my face, going, this is what I've been working towards for four chapters, is just this bit. And to write it as well as I could, that was, you know, one of the bits I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the other bit where you see the Plague Doctor outfit. It's hanging on a hook in the hall, and it just starts, the clothes start lifting themselves up and putting themselves together and forming a Plague Doctor. And again, you're going, that's a classic sort of Doctor Who moment of being quite spooky. Not too spooky, but, you know, but also it would be incredibly cheap to do. More effective to do. And I find the reason why I say it's cheap to do in Doctor Who is I think if you have things, scenes which are too spectacular in these sort of novels, you know, if you went sort of a huge Hollywood budget, it would start losing the feel of Doctor Who. I think actually you do need that human scale to the threat, almost, you need to have the sort of charm. So I tend to write think stories which, where the things which are scary are things which are quite cheap as well. I mean, the big example, there's an acrophobia where the monsters are just people with clocks instead of faces, which is and monsters that you can achieve under £10 go.
Pop down to the charity shop and make your own monster costume. Love that. I love that. And something that I just realised this week was that the book was never given an audio release.
Yeah, it's I think I wrote it with Bill Potts quite foregrounded, because I was sort of hoping, you know, that Paul Mackey would be asked to read it, because they often asked companions in to read one of them, or they'd get Peter Capaldi to read it, I don't know, but or, you know, they'd get Matt Lucas. But yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I mean, the doors on these things are never quite closed, you know, so. And it, I think it's come out in Italy and possibly Germany, so there might be Italian and German talking books first. you know, Doctor Who's really big in Germany, so who knows? Yeah, it was disappointing, but I took it philosophically of going, am I going to get paid any more for this? No. so it doesn't affect me financially. It doesn't affect my career. It would have just been a nice thing. And yeah. Also, it would have been a nice thing because for Touched by the Angel, I was there in the studio while Claire Corbett was reading it. And it was really useful to have me in the studio in terms of fixing errors in the text. But it's also just a lovely thing to do, lovely thing to attend. So I missed that. I missed the chance of being in a studio hearing it read out. But who knows? You know, they've run out of target books very soon, so who knows what they'll do next.
Yeah, just when you mentioned the international editions, I'd love to know how they've done the Scots text in there and who had the job of translating that.
I don't have a copy of it, but yes, it would be, I assume they just write it as Denmark or something. I mean, Germany does have all these different dialects, doesn't it? Yeah. So, I don't know. They would probably just roll their eyes and go, oh, God, what was he thinking? It's too much. It's too much.
Fantastic. So how do you look back on it now? The cover says fear is contagious. And I have to say, my enjoyment of this book is hopefully contagious. I really, really loved it. Not just being biased because it's you, my pal, who's written it, and the fact it's set in Scotland with my favourite new series, Doctor. That's just coincidence.
Well, I'm very proud of the characterization of the regulars in particular. I think that works really, really well. I'm very happy with that. And there's some really good jokes in there. It's quite funny all the way through. And the historical flavor, I sort of did my research, you know, quite assiduously, and, you know, found old novels written describing Edinburgh about 100 years later and went, okay, that's what it looked like then, so I can sort of get it right. I had a map of Edinburgh at the time, which I was referring to. You know, I was trying to work out how the buildings were, because according to one account, there were 11 stories, another there were 13, and it's like, still very high. So the historical colour and details are really good. I think what I find interesting, looking back on it now, is this was published in 2018, is it? 2018?
17, I think.
2017.
Yep, 2017.
Yeah. So, of course, people reading it go, we've got no idea what it would be like to live through a plague. We've got no idea what it would be like to confine to your houses or have curfews or have, you know, guards making sure that you couldn't go out in groups of more than two, or that people who broke the rules would be pilloried. And so suddenly, you know, this story at the time, which is quite sort of, it's not lighthearted, but it's like, it's a little trip down historical alleyway to go, here's something you will not have experienced. And then from 2020 and 21, you read it and go, oh God, this is just like, this brings it all back. This is actually quite close to how it felt. You know, how people felt isolated. That was the sort of the most painful thing. All that, you know, when people, the amount of loss and the amount of grief and the amount of buried grief. So all the stuff which was in the story, which was me just being imaginative, putting myself in the shoes of these people, and reading it out, it feels a bit more close to home. So that's an interesting aspect of the book you don't normally get.
Yeah, well, there we go. We made it. we made it through. So yeah, it's very interesting just to put it in that context. There we go. But no, Johnny, thank you so much. Fascinating as always.
So I think I can't think of anything else to say about it. So you have exhausted my anecdotes. Lovely talking to you, Kenny.
Brilliant. Thanks, Johnny. Speak to you soon. Big thanks to Johnny for his time. Great chat as always. Good fun. And my goodness, this is such a good book. I loved it, but am I the only one? I don't think so. Let's now pop over to find out what Doctor Who magazine had to say about it in their contemporary review, coming from issue 513, where it was reviewed by pal of the podcast, Stuart Manning, because this was one of three books released at the time, so we're going to hear how they reviewed this one. Finally comes Jonathan Morris's Plague City, which takes Matt Lucas's Nardole along for the ride as well, depositing the three-strong TARDIS crew in 1645 Edinburgh, at the height of the plague. It's surprising to note that Capaldi's Scottish-accented Doctor has yet to make it north of the border on screen, when it feels like such obvious territory for him. The Scottish capital's murky, fog-filled backstreets, replete with ominous bird-headed plague doctors and the spectre of death, complement Capaldi's haunted interpretation of the Doctor perfectly. While the 12th Doctor of Plague City feels authentic and vividly drawn, Nardole and Bill occasionally ring less true on the page. Bill is doubtless well characterised, but sometimes feels at arm's length from Peril Mackey's performance. As on screen, Nardole is there adding comic relief, acting like a deadpan cowardly lion, who later gets to prove his worth when it's needed most. Morris is an assured storyteller, constructing an efficient, complex tale of ghosts and resurrection, and that trades high on its sense of atmosphere and place, yet still finds time to explore Bill's ongoing education into the perils of time travel and causality. The story itself is rooted in body horror, with the hopeless plague backdrop lending an unremittingly morbid air that sets it apart from many of Doctor Who's recent and more romanticised visits to the past, the social commentary of Thin Ice notwithstanding. One senses that the show would rarely dare tread this line, but Bill's interactions with the local characters and some well-observed lines about the nature of grief give the closing scenes a welcome optimism that helps balance some of the bleaker aspects. With Peter Capaldi approaching the last lap of his time on Doctor Who, recent episodes have felt bittersweet, ushering in a reinvigorated TARDIS crew, but one for whom the clock is already counting down. The 12th Doctor, Bill and Nardole, will have their afterlife and further stories. But for now, we should savour them in the present tense. I'd still like to see Doctor Who and the Knock Knock in paperback eventually, but right now, three extra stories for this TARDIS crew are far more valuable. So there we go. I'd say that's a fairly positive review from DWM. I liked it. I think that the elements, particularly when they mentioned there that Bill getting to meet a couple of wee old ladies who evidently enjoyed living together, shall we say. And yeah, it was nicely done. A really nice touch. And particularly when I think at one point Bill gets to mention that she'd found a bomber jacket covered in badges, so yeah, could definitely picture Peril Mackey wearing Ace's coat. So there we go. Yep, for me, good book, recommended, damn good read, and fingers crossed that there is an audiobook at some point in the future. I live in hope. I am a defiant optimist after all. So there we go, that's us. Episode 12. I will be back tomorrow with Dave at my side as we feature a 13th Doctor adventure. And if you listen to a previous run, you might be able to work out which one it's going to be. It would be amazing if you could work it out, but we shall see. So, until tomorrow, I will leave you with a tune. Now, Johnny just mentioned that when he was looking for songs for this, he went onto Twitter and got people to name their most depressing songs. So it seems appropriate that we should play out with one of them, even though this has been a joyous, happy episode of The Power of Three. So here we are with How Soon Is Now by The Smiths. But just imagine Peter Capaldi playing it as he walks through the streets of Edinburgh. I can see that. Bye! All the shyness that is criminally vulgar, I am summoner of nothing in particular. Shut your mouth, how can you say?
summoner of nothing in particular.